Good afternoon to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM, and welcome to everyone tuning in over the internet at cjtr.ca. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Thanks to Canadian band Mr. Something Something from Toronto and the Afrobeat poet Ikwunga for our theme song, You Are Beautiful. My name is Jim Hutchings. This week I'm joined by my co-host Mona Hill. Good morning, Mona. It's good afternoon, isn't it?
Good afternoon, Jim.
And we have a special guest, Jess Tipton. Good afternoon, Jess.
Hi.
Yeah. We need to know a little bit more about...
Yes, And this week we'll be exploring the world of technology and the praxis with human rights, or technology as a human right, and or for human rights. Kind of cryptic, don't you think?
Well, it is, but that's actually part of the problem, and hopefully we'll elaborate on that enough that people will understand it. But.
And now we've got to the good part. This is Mona's description of you.
Okay.
With Jess Tipton,
dun, dun, dun.
Technology wizard, and owner of modworks.com.
And there was more?
Oh, there's more? Yeah. No, there isn't.
But wait,
Jess Tipton, my personal...
No, you didn't say
that. I didn't write that in there?
You didn't write that down.
Oh, maybe you took it out.
No, I
you have the mic. You can just verbalize
you printed it
yourself.
Yeah.
Jess Tipton is my personal geek. And longtime friend. And techno whiz, absolutely. Welcome, Jess. We're really happy to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, let's carry on.
Okay, let's carry on. I have a couple of things to announce, too, before we get into this, because I don't want to interrupt it in the middle. But this is really important information for some of you out there who would want to know about this. On Saturday, May 14th, and Sunday, May 15th, and I'll be talking about this every week, just to remind you, there will be a fundraising concert for relief for the people in Japan. It's titled The Kanpai to Recovery. Regina musicians have volunteered their time and talent to play at a two-night concert fundraiser to assist the victims of the recent earthquakes and tsunamis in Japan. All of the net profits generated from this concert will be donated to the Canadian Red Cross. So advance tickets are only $10 a night or $15 for a weekend. I mean, what more could you ask? Regina's just famous for having, you know, cheap nights but great entertainment. And if you want to pay at the door, you have to add $2, which is still not a big deal. And so if you want more information, you can contact Reagan Hinchcliffe at 306-591-3275. The second thing I want to talk about is a recent release by Amnesty International Canada on Canada's recent human rights record. It's rather stark, and there's a few things that I wanted to just discuss and let you know about. The fact that Salil Shetty, the Secretary General for Amnesty International, talks about a scathing report on Canada's recent rights record at a news conference on Parliament Hill in Ottawa back in March on the 31st, or around there. He says, the criticism it raises of foreign policy under the Tories include what Amnesty describes as a tilt toward Israel and the Middle East and the defunding of non-governmental agencies such as Kairos that have publicly criticized the Tories or sided with Palestinians. And the point here is that Amnesty calls on political party leaders to use the federal election campaign to restore Canada's commitment to rights at home and abroad. No longer the champion, more and more, Canada is perceived to be a country that is reticent to take a consistently strong stand for human rights. Sometimes Canada is now being seen as part of the problem rather than a solution. And this is a quote from Amnesty Secretary General Salil Shetty. There has been an erosion of Canada's past policies, including a principle, the nonpartisan reputation in the Middle East. Let's see what we have here. Traditionally, Canada approaches debates in the Middle East in a careful and principled manner and garnered a reputation as nonpartisan, and this is not happening lately. There have been serious violations committed by the Israeli government, and they have on occasion been described as a measured response on Canada's voice, and it was noticeably moderated when hundreds of thousands of Sri Lankan Tamils faced grave peril early in 2009. Our reputation has been completely eroded in recent years, as Canada has now adopted a policy of consistently voting against resolutions at both the UN Human Rights Council and the UN General Assembly that criticize Israel's human rights record. This has been the case even in the midst of UN criticism of the widespread human rights violations that occurred during the Israeli military campaigns in South Lebanon in 2006 and Gaza in 2009. At home, the report points to devastating cuts in funding to Canadian agencies such as CAROS and the Canadian Council for International Cooperation for publicly disagreeing with government policy. On the home front, Canada's human rights movement feels under siege, the report states. Never before have Canadian organizations worried so much that there might be consequences if they disagree publicly with the government on a human rights concern. The report also notes the government's decision to not repatriate Toronto-born convicted terrorist Omar Khadr from the U.S. military prison in Guantanamo Bay. If you want to read this report in full, you can go to the Amnesty International website, amnestycanada.ca. So I just wanted to bring that up.
And now, the other thing is that we would encourage people who are interested in human rights to ask your candidate about it. Ask questions about Canada's commitment to human rights and their personal commitment to human rights. So there.
I think that's a good idea.
Just as a quick aside, even though it's dead on topic, all the things that you just talked about wouldn't have been possible without technology.
Okay, what a wonderful segue. Jess told me a computer is often seen as a perk or a frill or a privilege, but it's his point that they're not. Wait, I want to finish reading it because it's good. It's good. While they can be a privilege, we're not talking about handing out supercomputers to the poor. We're talking about connecting humanity and allowing learning and communication. The ability to participate in the global culture and community and to freely educate oneself despite geographical hindrance, etc. Take it away.
Well, that's essentially what you just talked about. I mean, if we didn't have television, satellites, computers, the internet, who's going to know what's going on in Gaza? Who's going to find out what's going on in Israel? Unless you get on a plane and go there. Wait a minute, planes are technology. Okay, but for the purpose of this show, technology isn't about, you know, the fact that we make forks out of iron ore and things like that. Technology, as defined by this show, will realistically be focusing on internet-connected devices. So nowadays it's smartphones, laptops, basic computers, which realistically we have to start thinking about the fact that, well, our TVs are now also connected to the internet.
You know, Netflix.
Speak for yourself.
Some people's fridges are connected to the internet. Some people's fridges not only have the ability to report what they're low on, but they also have TVs and touchscreen devices up
really?
Front. And, oh, yeah.
Holy cow.
So the reality is, you know, we're kind of moving to this point where everything at some point is going to be connected to the internet. And this can be seen as both an apocalyptic fear thing, but at the same time, it can also be very useful. And the fact that it can go either or is kind of one of the bigger topics.
It's kind of like real life, isn't it? I mean, everything we do in our everyday living can be seen as something positive. We can take a positive viewpoint and we can do positive things, or we can choose to have negative things happening and to facilitate negative things in our daily living.
Right. It's just, I mean, the internet and the devices that connect to it are tools. Humanity is a race that depends on its tools. Since the dawn of time, we had to make tools, clubs and hammers. And a hammer is a great example of this flip-flop, good or bad. You can use it to build a house, or you can smash somebody in the head with it, you know. It's a tool nonetheless, but your use of it, your actions with it, define how it's seen, right? If everybody goes around smashing other people in the head with hammers, we're probably not going to have a very good view of hammers. You know, we're going to kind of think that, you know, they should be sitting alongside Uzis and submachine guns and such. But if we're building houses with them as the primary sort of use, they're kind of a good thing.
That's something positive, yeah.
So, technology has just as much opportunity to scare and hurt as it does to, you know, help. And
right.
And realistically, what we're trying to look for is, the, you know, the way to keep it helping. You know, we want to be able to connect with each other across the world. And one of the things I wanted to touch on today, and maybe this will be the only mention I get, but the XO Project. For people that don't know what the XO Project is, it's better known as the One Laptop Per Child. Okay. So what this is we have a private organization that's trying to get technology, in this case primarily computers, laptops, to children in Africa and third world countries so that they can learn, so that they can have an education where geographically they might not have the opportunity, where their government may not care enough to give them that opportunity. There are certain countries where women aren't quite viewed the same as men, right? So the boys get the education, the girls get to clean the house. Well, if they can get a hold of a computer, they now have resources to start learning things. Mm-hmm. Albeit there might be some need for some interim stuff like teaching them to read, but mm-hmm. the idea is trying to get people connected so that they can mm-hmm. teach themselves, so that they have the independence rather than what their possibly dictatorship government tells them. China is a great example. If I, let's try some word association. If I said the Great Wall of
China.
Mm-hmm. China. Okay, but how many Great Walls does China have? Two. Okay, there's the Great Wall of China.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's also
the physical wall.
There's also the Great Firewall of China.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
okay,
yes.
In which they censor everything in and out. You know, at least they try to. But the idea is that they're keeping their people from learning. They're keeping their people from finding things out, human rights violations, which that country is ripe with. You know, essentially it's a nation of slaves working in factories so that you and I can buy an iPhone. Oh, I don't want to endorse the A word there, but I said the I word. But the point is that there's huge human rights violations going on, which is kind of the dark side of technology.
Mm-hmm.
When we're talking about, green initiative and all these other things with our devices, they're not green. There's no possible mm-hmm. way our technology is green. No matter what anybody says, it's not. The chemicals used to design those parts are brutal. And mm-hmm. you have this massive nation of essentially slaves making it. So it's a pretty grim reality. You know, when the next time you sit down at your computer, you think about the little 12-year-old that had to build it. You know, it's not the greatest thing to envision, but
okay,
that's just one of many points.
Right. Yeah. Okay, let's go back to those 2 points. I have 2 questions. The first one is in reference to finding a way to get laptops into developing nations where, for purposes of education, what about an oppressive government that perhaps would not allow, wouldn't they have to be in charge of setting up wireless internet?
That's actually one of the problems that the XOs solve by themselves.
Oh. How's that?
Basically, what they do is they are themselves a mesh network.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as somebody else has an XO on, and typically where they're trying to distribute these, you have a town or a community full of kids that now have these devices. And they connect to each other. And the laptops are actually loaded with all the software and the
really?
Books and things that they typically need. They can connect to traditional APs, access points and Wi-Fi and things like that. But if they don't have access to that, they look for each other. And one of the problems that they solved by this was they were thinking about, well, these have to be very low-cost devices. They have to be able to run in very hot, harsh environments,
right.
No power outlets.
Right.
They're crank-powered for their power.
Okay, just good.
One of the other things, however, is they use this mesh network because the onboard memory is limited. So they thought, if we want to deliver 50,000 books to these children for them to read and to learn and to grow from, how do we do that when we can only fit, say, 10 on every laptop?
Mm-hmm.
So what they did was they put 10 unique books on every machine that went over. So once everybody's connected to their peers, to the people that are next to them, mm-hmm. they all have access to the other person's 10 books.
Uh-huh.
So they essentially grew it from 10 books per laptop,
mm-hmm.
but essentially you have access to 50,000 if you're in proximity of the other people with their reading material. So the whole design concept was really based on the fact that they're not sitting around near power outlets in a cafe like we
right.
are.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a big challenge, and it still is a big challenge. The XO Project still, marches on. They're trying to build better devices and get them over there. But it's just one example of how technology is being used to kind of better things, because these children typically don't have very good odds for education.
Mm-hmm.
But because they have this, you know, for example, they now understand what a computer is. They have some experience with using them. And technically, I would dare say that they're actually a little bit more savvy than some people, because even though the interface is designed for children, they're technically running Linux.
Mm-hmm.
And Linux is like a big, scary, bad word to a lot of people here in the Western world. And that in itself is very disparaging to me, because I have a lot of people, and actually it came up in debate before this show, that say, well, people are more apt to run the commercial, the big popular operating systems and software, because if they have problems, it's easier to troubleshoot. But the reality is most of the people that need help troubleshooting this stuff are no more suited to troubleshoot the popular software than the obscure software.
Oh, stop talking about me. That's me.
It's bad, because people aren't opening themselves up to the realities that really come with running this popular software. And that's actually one of the bigger topics for today. Mm-hmm. Is they're typically not only popular, but there are also huge privacy concerns. So not only do we have technology, you know, enabling certain things, but we have it hindering certain things. But the big catch, however, is that it's kind of seen from several perspectives in the term, or in the case of human rights, right? Because we have it being a part of our lives. It actually defines a lot of who we are in the Western world and in Europe and well, pretty much everywhere. Now that with the XO on, I mean, even in the plains of Africa, to some degree, okay. It's defining who we are.
Okay.
But we also have a lot of problems with that. Not only our rights to access it, but our rights while using it. And then there's the right to the access and owning the hardware to use it. I mean, the splits in perspective when we're dealing with this are huge.
I can see that.
I just wanted to ask you a question.
Wait.
With regard to that.
Okay.
Hold on.
In line.
Yeah, you're going to get in line, because I want to bring this back to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
I just wanted to talk about the cloud. Do you use the cloud? Do you believe in the cloud?
Actually, you know what? That's an awesome question. Everybody's talking about the cloud. The cloud is a dangerous thing, people. I do use the cloud. However, it's my own.
Could we define the cloud before we talk about the cloud?
Okay, so for those that don't know what the cloud is talking about decentralized storage. So, for example, you'll have your data, your contacts, your pictures, your music, everything is basically stored on a server, which is not owned by you, somewhere out in the world. And this allows you to access your stuff no matter where you are. Right now, some people talk about the cloud as being able to connect your machine back at home. You could kind of say that that's the cloud, but typically the cloud is kind of this third party owned by somebody else service. And it's dangerous, because to use those services, you typically have to agree to their terms, in which case they usually make a lot of money off of the things that you put on there, whether you realize it or not. And on top of that, your data is on that server, and that server is physically somewhere else in the world, which means that it's also subject to law according to where it's physically sitting. So, for example, if you have something that is legal where you live, right, and you put it on that machine, the law enforcement there can seize that stuff, because it's not subject to, you know, your jurisdiction. You are now in violation of the law of the country that your data is residing in.
Well, yeah, let me stop you there, and I'll give it back to Mona.
I wanted to refer to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, because Jess has been talking a lot about educating people in developing nations, educating children, educating women with laptops through the, what's the name of the project, the XO? So,
well, it's the one laptop per child. XO is actually
okay,
a plastic sort of emblem that's on the top of the laptops, so they kind of get the nickname XO.
Oh, okay. In Article 26 of the Declaration, it states that everyone has a right to education. Education shall be free, at least in the elementary and fundamental stages. It should be compulsory, and technical and professional education shall be made generally available, and higher education shall be equally accessible to all on the basis of merit.
Exactly.
Education should be directed to the full development of the human personality and to the strengthening of respect for human rights and fundamental freedoms. It shall promote understanding, tolerance, and friendship amongst all nations, racial or religious groups, and shall further the activities of the United Nations for the maintenance of peace. That sort of makes me think about the fact that the average person who has, and correct me if I'm wrong, the average person who has access to the internet in general is someone of a higher class, someone with access to employment, or any kind of sort of provision of income, and therefore, sort of historically speaking, it's not much different than any other kind of education, where if you don't have access to, in the old days, to books, just plain books and pencils paper.
You're making the segue easy.
You're losing the opportunity. So this, I think, is so important to direct this towards. Now we have this technology, so what do we do about this? And I'm really glad that you brought up the issue of the one laptop per person. Okay, we got five minutes left.
So I'll see if I can get this in 5 minutes. You really brought up a big thing. One of the things that I kind of wanted to mention was libraries.
Okay.
You mentioned books and all these other things, and this is perfect. You couldn't make the segue easier, because libraries are really a good indication of why having the internet should be now a human right. You think about, what was the purpose of a library? It was to afford people that couldn't otherwise have access to literature and educational materials.
Right.
So realistically, you think about, well, what else can you get at a library now? Access to the internet. So essentially what we've done is we've kind of solidified that this isn't something that's just frivolous so that you can play games or be stupid online with your friends. There's billions of things you can do online. But the reality is that it is one of the most major and revolutionary things that we as humanity have done. And having access to that is vital. And I think the fact that the library is kind of the gateway for the people that can't afford the devices to access it otherwise is really, really important.
Yeah.
However, with the way things have become, as I said earlier, virtually everything is connected to the internet now. Commodity devices are dropping in price and everything else. I know people that are living in incredibly impoverished conditions that have access to the internet in their pocket.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't necessarily mean that everybody can do it.
Well, we're talking cell phones, aren't we?
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
So, no, don't get me wrong. Data plans can be expensive and stuff, but the idea is that we've gotten things down to the point where they're pretty affordable in contrast to how they used to be, as you said, historically speaking. A book would have been a deal breaker for somebody back in the day. Same with the internet. We're actually kind of to the point now where even the poor people can kind of afford to be online themselves. But that's great for us here in the Western world. There's lots of parts of the world that's not the case.
Right.
Not the case. So.
This is getting so big.
Trust me, it can get worse.
Oh, I know. And the other thing you touched on earlier, Jess, was the sort of the Great Wall of China in terms of the firewall,
yes,
right?
The censorship.
And this is something that we've seen also recently in the Middle East.
Yes.
The uprisings where the internet has been shut down in different countries in order to stop people from getting information to the rest of the world.
That's right. Don't look at our violations.
Right. And the thing is people have been able to get through, though, in other ways, but through technology.
Yeah.
There's other technologies. So thankfully, they haven't been able to shut it down completely. I was listening to an interview on CBC with somebody live as I was in my car one day, who was on the telephone from one of Middle Eastern countries, I forget which one, who was talking about what was going on right now.
Yeah.
I think it was Libya, right at the beginning, when they were being fired upon, when the protesters were being attacked.
This is where the beauty of satellites come into play, right? You're jumping over your wired backbones on the ground, and you're able to bypass that. Shoot to a satellite uplink, and boom, you're in Europe.
Right.
So it's not the easiest thing in some cases, and obviously there's things that can go wrong. But yeah, our ability to leapfrog and to deal with things has really, really developed all of these issues that we see. The eyes aren't just on us anymore, from us. The eyes are on everybody from everybody. And this lends itself to privacy issues that we can get into after the break. Because the privacy of what we do online is horribly, horribly awry.
Right, yeah.
I just
wanted to say that we've got information here before we go to the break that a Costa Rican court declared the internet as a fundamental right. The Constitutional Council implicitly concluded that internet access is a universal human right on which allows users to participate in civil society, which is unalienable from our human nature.
And that's in the Declaration of Human Rights as well.
See you after the break.
And that's a little interesting. A little bit out of the way for music for
possibly.
What were we listening to there, Jess?
It's actually fitting for all of the people that actually own a physical copy of the Oblivion's Eye album, Radiance. That's a bonus track called 8-Bit Realms. It's a version of one of our songs where all the guitars, bass, and synths have been replaced by 16-bit, 8-bit sound generators. So it's technology based. In itself, so
like, it's all computer generated,
with the exception of
you're screaming,
except for my drums and Brad's vocals. Yeah,
oh Brad,
shameless self promotion. I happen to be a drummer and vocalist for Oblivion's Eye. So,
oh, so we were listening to
you're listening to me. Oh. See, it fits not only theme wise, thematically it works, but it's also something that I legally have the right to air. Okay. So it fits both bills.
Right. So we got permission.
Right. You have permission sitting right here. Now, of course, the other band members might object, but I can tell them off.
You'll
on Facebook later.
Okay. So we're back on Human Rights Radio. Welcome back. If you were not here at the top of the hour, I'll fill you in. Our topic is technology as a human right and or for human rights with Jess Tipton, who is my geek, and TechnoWiz, and we're talking about the computer being seen as a perk or a frill or a privilege, but the fact is computers in terms of education and all the technology involved in education and human rights issues. We've been talking about the firewall in China, for instance, and having internet access shut down in the Middle East recently so that people don't have access to the outside world or cannot get information out to the outside world, how that definitely affects our human rights. And the second thing I wanted to bring up was illness and disability and how technology is so important and how it can affect our human rights and to be able to maybe earn a living, for instance, to be educated with assistive devices. So go ahead and talk
about that. Assistive devices is exactly it. When you know, before the break, when you're talking about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, you know, and it's talking about being able to participate in society. Our society is not just face-to-face. And for people that are bedridden or homebound, for people with severe disabilities, these devices absolutely define their ability to achieve that right. Look at Stephen Hawking.
Right.
Where would he be without his voice box?
And where would we be without Stephen Hawking?
Exactly. So we're talking about something that that realistically bridges so many gaps. As I said earlier, it is one of the biggest things that we've done as humanity. And the thing that, that bothers me most when we talk about disability, I have to kind of hone in on Canada, is when we talk about things like this and assistive programs, social programs, a lot of the times they take the view that these devices and machines are perks. Now, if you're severely disabled, you can usually get away with it, but oftentimes to receive social programs, they'll, if it's a financial situation, they'll actually, you know, if you declare that you have these things, they'll tell you to sell them off.
Oh,
you know,
yeah?
In order to support yourself, and then come back and we'll talk about helping you. So that's really kind of
Can you give
a,
us an example of that?
Well, I mean, for example, if you're working and you go out and you buy yourself a computer, a laptop, and, you know, one day you get injured, and for whatever circumstances, we're being hypothetical, the details don't matter, I guess, but you end up where you're in a situation where you need to be on assistance.
Okay.
If you tell them, hey, I have this $1,200 computer that I just bought, they'll tell you to sell it. But the reality is that $1,200
yes.
computer is going to be not only for the fact that you bought that with your money that you worked for, it's not, you know, it's kind of like saying I bought $1,200 worth of clothes. Are they going to tell you to sell your clothes in order to survive? They won't. But your computer, bye-bye.
So you've had personal experience with this with somebody you know? Or
I've had tons of experience with this.
Okay.
I've actually donated tons of computers that I've refurbished to people that have had these situations happen.
Okay.
And the reality is that computer helps them deal with their illness, their disability, whatever's got them in their situation. It affords them the ability to find work and get off of that social program. There are so many things. And a lot of these people have mobility issues.
Right.
And so now they tell you, go and sell that computer so that you can pay your rent for another month. And now that you don't have that, come back and talk to us and maybe we'll help you out. But don't worry, your mobility issues, you know, oh, I'm sure you can walk to that their library we talked about because they have internet access. Even though it's, you know, a 40-minute walk and 40 below weather, the misunderstanding of these organizations towards technology and how much it bridges the gaps is incredible. You know, they have this sort of fairy tale view of it, like, you know, it's a TV. Granted, TV is pretty commonplace now, but TV is really a frill. I mean, it's not quite as useful as a computer.
Unless your computer is hooked up to your TV.
Yeah, right. But I mean, still,
for internet access.
Unplug the TV and you have the computer.
You know, I currently, in some of the work that I've been doing, I've been working with people in pre-employment programs. And one of the things that we're doing is helping them to understand that nowadays, and this was hard for me to learn, being an old person, that you can't just walk into a place where you might like to work and say, I'd like to see the human resources manager.
Yeah.
You have to apply online.
Take
you
a psych
have
test.
To learn how to Oh, yes. And there's so much technology that you have to know, you have to be familiar with. So if you don't have this technology, if you don't have the computer in order to learn that sort of stuff and in order to use it to apply for a job, your chances are very limited in finding work in many respects.
And people think that a lot of the times trades are immune from this sort of thing, and it's not true. I mean, you look at auto mechanics. Auto mechanics are using computers all the time for timing and alignment and all sorts of things.
Right.
Now, granted, you won't see too many computers on a site building a house, but how long till that changes? You still got laser levels and a few other things that actually have some sophisticated hardware on them. So, I mean, really, to do any sort of work in general in humanity, you pretty much will have to know computers to some degree. And taking people's ability to interface with these devices every day to keep their skills up, to keep themselves current, is suicide. I mean, it's just not helping anybody find work, find sustainability. It's just, it blows my mind that these organizations will actually kind of deprive you of these things.
Right. I think also we need to sort of toss in education there in terms of people with disabilities. I myself, I've mentioned this on the air, of a learning disability. When I went back to school, the fact that I was able to access a computer in order to write my exams made a big difference to me, a huge difference. What it did was it leveled the playing field due to my disability so that it was even with people who don't have the same sort of challenge that I have.
Yeah.
And without that, I may not have been able to become the social worker that I am and be able to give back to my community and be there for others.
Yeah, and that's a big part of it, is really enabling people to get out there and overcome things. And I mean, that goes for everybody here in Canada. It goes for people in the U.S., all the way back to third world countries. It gives us all the ability, to some extent, to level the playing field, to have commonality, to have a shared resource of knowledge that will actually pull humanity forward and allow us to take our own personal experience and apply it to these more global situations to help make things better. And right now, the situation is fairly grim. People are terrified of technology. We have all these misconceptions about it. And fear-mongering in the world of technology is huge. It's really hard, in my experience, to get people to care about technology that don't care about technology. And people think that our children are so much more literate, but they're not. My experience is our children are worse than we are. They're less willing to learn. Devices have become such a commodity that if it somewhat breaks, they don't care. They'll throw it away. I'll just get a new one.
Yeah.
They don't want to learn it. They don't want to fix it.
Yeah.
And this technology runs our lives. We can't afford to be ignorant to how it affects us, because if anything goes wrong, you're kind of, in a sense, you're not equipped to defend yourself against the problems that arise. And the fear-mongering and the lies start to filter in, and it's very easy to be taken advantage of on top of everything else. And this really segues into the issues that we face on the front of privacy.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where this is such a huge topic, because it enables human rights, and technology also causes human rights issues, but having the ability to use it is only half the battle with this stuff, because from there, again, the fear, the inability to be consistent with it, and the misinformation that's out there really causes more problems for anybody that's trying to sort of take advantage of what humanity has become. And that's what using the internet is to me. It's taking advantage of what humanity has become and what we are becoming. So,
okay. I have another interesting fact here that Jess gave me. The former Soviet Republic, where parliament has declared internet access a basic human right, this is happening in Russia, is ahead of European Union countries like France, and so on and so forth. Internet connected devices allow humanity to research, learn, and claim or defend their rights.
Yep.
So we've got Russia, we've got Costa Rica, who have decided that having technology and having the internet is a basic human right.
And you think Costa Rica, you don't really think high tech, you know. So the fact for them that they acknowledge such a thing, you know, really shows that they are forward looking. And there's actually a lot of really small countries in Europe that have done the same. And it really just kind of goes to show that they've not only identified how important this is, but they've also identified how important it is to their people to get an advantage in the world market for business, for education, for everything. Because that's kind of what it comes down to. And I guess the big thing for me from here really comes down to the clutch of problems that people face when they're dealing with this. Because like I said, my experience over the years is people don't care. They're scared of it. They don't think that they can learn it. And they have all these misconceptions. And one of the biggest problems with these misconceptions really boils down to privacy. People just kind of take what's put in front of them, you know, what's easiest. And they end up actually trying to partake in this new form of humanity, but they do it through ways that actually violate their own human rights, and they violate them themselves willingly through the fact that they're just not paying attention.
But what about the fact, okay, I'm going to play devil's advocate here.
Okay.
We've heard in the past of, well, if I haven't done anything wrong, then it should be okay for the government to know about my life.
No.
I haven't done anything wrong, so why is that a problem, right?
Right.
Cameras at downtown, London, I think was one of the first cities to
CCC
do this.
CCC counts, yeah.
There are cameras all over downtown, and there are elements of the population that feel this is fine because I'm not doing anything wrong. And they're here here to catch people who are doing things wrong. Let's take that and move it into the technology aspect, that if I have nothing on my computer that's even going to the store, this is really something that really ticks me off. Can I have your phone number if you want to buy something from my store?
That's an issue for me. But
I've talked to people who have said, well, I don't mind giving them my phone number because I have nothing to hide.
People are very into this thing. And I was actually just talking about this yesterday. People have this really weird thing where if it's online, somehow they don't get basic logic anymore. There are sets of commonality and common sense just kind of go out the window because it's got to be magical if it's online. The reality is almost every service, every major service, and by service I mean social networking websites, email, classified sites, there's tons of these things, and they all make their money off of you, your personal information. And it's no different than going to I'm not going to name names, but any of the common big name grocery stores.
Right.
And what do? They offer you a little bit off for you to carry around a card with their logo on it and present it every time you check out. Now, why would they do that? It's exactly the same thing. Because if you go into the store and you buy a carton of milk, all they know when you walk out is that they sold one carton of milk. But if they can find out who you are, what your annual income is, phone number, they have an understanding of what their customers are buying. And they can not only sell that to other people, but then they can start tailoring their inventory a little bit better.
It's marketing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the end result is that you are valuable. Everything about you is valuable to somebody. Exactly. Let me tell you something. As somebody that does web design, web hosting, and a ton of other things, Facebook is the greatest example. Not only have their privacy violations been immense, but Facebook as a technical back end, right? You can't run a website that huge without a lot of money. Where do they make their money? Do you pay for your Facebook account? No, exactly. They make their money from selling your personal information to advertisers. No matter what you think, no matter what you set your privacy settings to, you have signed away your life to make Facebook money by joining Facebook. Okay? It's that simple. Your privacy, no matter what you set your privacy to, is gone. You have agreed to it.
Even if you change your little privacy settings?
It doesn't matter. You have legally agreed to give these people permission to sell you down the river.
Okay.
And Microsoft is no better with Bing and Hotmail. Google, I think it's funny that people focus on Facebook so much when Google's right beside them in privacy violations. And for people that reside in the U.S., their search queries could be research for a school project.
Mm-hmm.
But if they match the right criteria, Google may or may not give them to the local authorities, and they'll pay you
a visit.
Because
they look for words, don't they? Words and phrases.
If you're doing a research paper on,
terrorism?
The Unabomber, exactly. And this is where the argument that if I'm not doing anything wrong, I have nothing to fear is a load of bullocks.
Look at what happened to those two girls that were denied access to that Stephen Harper thing.
Yeah, exactly, because there was a photo
on Facebook,
the evil F.
Yep.
Of them with the other party leader.
Yeah.
Exactly. This is exactly it. And this is why having an understanding of what you're actually signing up for and what you're dealing with is important. And people think, it's so complex. And it is. But there are alternatives that will keep your privacy safe, keep it within your control, and allow you to manage things without selling you down the river. But this is a huge cultural issue. This fits in with what our internet has made us become as a culture. For anybody that's listening, if you're old enough to really remember the Cold War years, just take a moment, close your eyes, think back to then. Think back to what you would have done if your neighbor was peeking over your hedge, staring at your house. You'd have probably freaked out, because privacy was a valuable commodity back then. But what we've had is, along with the internet allowing us to connect, we've also had this cultural shift where we're all excruciatingly voyeuristic. We all want to show each other what our dog did yesterday and what our children did on their birthday. Nobody cares, but we want to show it. And so, in essence, we've kind of been coerced into not only embracing the internet, But embracing it in a way that makes us kind of throw common sense out the window. We don't value our privacy anymore. We all have this some weird delusion that we're going to become superstars by letting everybody on the planet know what we're doing today because, you know, I just posted on Twitter that I'm eating a sandwich. You know, it just doesn't make any sense. But we're constantly giving away our privacy. We're, you know, it's just ridiculous. We're violating common sense, you know, in essence, to just be a part of this. And that strange urge, that desire that is there in a good chunk of humanity right now that owns a computer is kind of the leading problem for privacy because culturally we're not only violating our own privacy and signing away our privacy, but we embrace the fact that we're just like handing
this
it over
true.
On a platter.
This is true. Our society is sort of turned into it. It's all about me, and I think everybody wants to know about me kind of thing. Let's go to Article 12 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. No one shall be subjected to arbitrary interference with his privacy, family, home, or correspondence, nor to attacks upon his honor and reputation. Everyone has the right to the protection of the law against such interference or attacks. And your comment on that is this could fit the bill for most online services.
Yeah.
As they spy on you and sell your user metrics, however you agree to allow this with most ELUA, which I don't know what that
and
is.
User license agreement.
Okay, and sign away your own rights. So that's where we connect that back to
this is
basic
actually,
human rights.
This is a good point. You know, if we ever have a discussion about this again, to have a lawyer on. And the catch with that is every lawyer knows the law of their country, right? And when we're signing up for these services, you know, Facebook may have servers in Canada, but they have servers in the U.S. You don't know where your data is stored. It's a very abstract reality, which causes a lot of the confusion for people like, oh, technology is so confusing. I don't care. It's just, I just use whatever's in front of me because it was just there and it's easy. That's not only dangerous thinking, unfortunately, but these things also make such things really subject to all these different laws and you don't know what's going on.
Right.
And that's why it's important to not use those services because, number one, do you really want to read that license agreement? Most of the time you don't. So that should be an indication that you don't want to use the service. If you need to know this crap to use it.
But how many people understand what's in the agreement?
That's exactly my point, though. You probably don't.
It's because the whole concept of reading the fine print.
Yeah, it's legalese. And
yes.
The reality is most of us can't understand it. And so this is a kind of a red flag right off the bat that we probably shouldn't be using it. I mean, if we need a lawyer to really sit down and understand that, you know, okay, so now if I upload a photo of myself, that they can use that in an advertisement somewhere in Japan. You know,
right, and
that's
this
kind
is
of
happening.
I don't want to go for that, but
yeah.
People do it anyways because
right.
It's the cool thing to do, and
right.
We're just throwing away our privacy. And
right.
The fact that it's not blaringly obvious seems to make it all the easier.
Right.
It's essentially like, you know, the government comes along and says, can you, you know, let us assign a guy to follow you around all the time, and we'll give you a nice shiny TV if you let us do it.
Okay.
And people are like, big TV. Okay,
yeah.
I'll take the big TV.
Yeah.
You know, and because the guy that's following them around kind of like paints himself to blend in with whatever room you're in at the time, you don't really notice that dude's staring at you writing notes. But that's exactly it. That's the exact real world analogy. There's somebody that's always there taking notes on you, sending it back to head office, making
right.
money off you. It's very sinister, but because it's not so obvious.
So what can be the dire consequences of all of this?
Well, realistically, we become enslaved. I mean,
without our permission or with our permission?
Well, with our permission. The reality is we're signing all these, you know, end user license agreements. Someday they can become so restrictive, you
click
might
yes,
as well
click
just be,
yes, click
yeah,
yes.
click yes. Everybody just a trigger finger with click yes, click
yeah.
yes. I don't care what it says. I mean, the idea that the governments are doing this to us as well is staggering. But because we're being placated with all these shiny little things, the masses, you know, seem to be just enough. You know, just asleep enough to not care anymore.
Right.
You know, this is what the First Amendment is for the, or I'm sorry, not the First Amendment, but the right to bear arms for American citizens. If your government gets a little wacky, you need to be able to deal with it. But now it's to the point where...
Oh, right. Everybody should have the right to carry a gun in their purse, take the gun to school.
Well, we're not talking about... this is where the hammer analogy comes in.
Yes.
If everybody starts smashing each other in
right.
the head, it becomes bad.
Right.
But the idea is, if you can't defend yourself from your government, you're in big trouble.
Right.
And that's the situation that we're in. And it applies to not only our human rights on a real life governmental level, but on the internet as well, because we're selling away our privacy and our rights on top of it too. Online, we're placated with this shiny service. Oh, we can be on Facebook if we just give up all this privacy. In real life, you know, oh, well, we're going to be safer if we give up this privacy and our rights because of the terrorists. So it's the same thing. They're just using a different mechanism to get us to give up our rights. You know,
okay.
On both sides of the fence, there's horrific amounts of fear mongering.
Yes.
And that's really kind of what drives a lot of things, right? So
to take the concept of fear mongering and turn this whole thing around for the last few minutes, let's go to fear mongering. And I'm not ever going to accuse you of being a fear monger, because some people might be listening to this and thinking, like, this is crazy. There's been nothing positive said about, you know, being putting your information on and sharing with your family and friends, you know, because maybe that's the only way you can do it. Let's turn it around to the positive aspects, because we want to have some balance. But always be aware. Absolutely be aware.
Well, it's about being aware to the point where you can make your own informed choice.
Make informed choices. Absolutely.
If you're okay with what that license agreement for whatever service you're using says, then that's fine.
Right. And if you don't understand it, get help. Understanding
exactly
what it means. And let's turn it around to the work that we do, for instance. I mean, you talked about earlier about, you know, people getting information out of a country when there's a war. We've touched on that. Human rights issues, that violations back in the old days. When we first started the show, you said, you know, in the old days you had to get on a plane and go to a country to find out what was going on there. We don't have to do that anymore.
When consumer level video cameras became kind of popular, cops were terrified when they did bad things because, you know, it was huge that somebody finally had a video camera at the right place at the right time. Now everybody has a video camera in their pocket.
Right.
Everybody.
So that could be negative,
but
it could also be really positive.
Right. It's
in
how
protecting
we use it.
People's human rights.
We can use these tools for either or. But they really facilitate on a basic level the ability to look out for each other.
Mm-hmm.
But when we're not paying attention to who's using them or what the legalities are behind them, we end up with places like, you know, over in, is it London or Britain? You know, they have like the highest CCC count in the world.
What's that?
Closed captioned.
Yes,
television.
Yes,
circuit television.
Yeah, it was the city of London. Yeah.
I mean, just as a side note, so that the listeners kind of get an idea of how ridiculous this is, a band over there actually shot their entire video using these cameras, because there, even though the cameras are there legally, anyone has right to view the footage.
Oh, is that right?
Which means that a stalker could also be getting right to use this footage. That said, they went to the city hall and they got all this footage where they had set the band up off across various locations across the city and played parts of their song and then edited it all together. So they actually used the city's resources to shoot their band video. But it's not so much, hey, that's a really great idea. It's there's that many cameras.
Right.
And they're publicly available to anybody that legally petitions it, which could be bad.
It could lead to stalking. It could lead to surveillance by someone who has malicious intent.
Right. And so we think that these things are, you know, oh, well, if I'm not doing anything bad, I got nothing to worry about. Yeah, well, tell that to the psycho in the bushes.
Yeah.
So really, this is a huge gray area of concern, because we can do wonderful things and we can do very scary things.
Yeah. And on that note, I believe that we're going to have another follow-up show to this, because we've got a lot more to talk about.
We basically opened a big can of worms without a whole lot of detail. And
but this is a good beginning to talk about technology as a human right and for human rights. And just before we leave, I wanted to just let everybody know that we have a few tickets left for the Amnesty International Steak Night next Tuesday at Bushwhackers from 5:30 to 8:30, $25 a ticket. If you were planning on getting tickets and you forgot, or you just haven't been able to get around to it, call 586-1938. And we will make sure that you get your tickets. But you have to have that money into me by tomorrow afternoon. So give us a call, and we'll make sure that you get your tickets and we get the money to the restaurant so that you can enjoy. We're going to have a little silent auction, too, and we're going to have lots of fun. And we have 1 minute left. And we're going to pass it over to Jim for a last comment, because I know it's killing him that he can't talk about this stuff with Jess.
No, I got nothing to say.
Nothing to say. I don't believe it.
You'll get your turn.
Yeah. It was Robert Jakansky. That's the one that was at the Vancouver airport that we saw him get tasered 5 times.
Oh.
Yes.
We wouldn't have known about
There's
that.
There's your
anyway,
positive.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
Anyway. It's looking out for one another and helping each other.
Yep.
And just for the issues of, I'm afraid of this legal bit, you can turn to other people online for the help with that.
Absolutely.
So
support groups. There's lots
there's
of them online.
There's so much positive.
Anyway, now I have to shut you down.
Okay.
We're volunteers.
Bye, everybody.
With Amnesty International, and our goal is to increase the awareness of and contribute to a discussion of human rights issues at home and around the world. Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."